shambling like a creature through the darkness and destroying the placidity. The duck cage was welded onto the back of the truck, but the door was unlocked. Billy Ray lifted the wire hatch and the cage came open. He pounded his fist on the roof of the cage and Mallard Fillmore fluttered off the flatbed to the dirt below. Billy Ray expected the bird to fly away, but instead, a stranger to autonomy, it waddled around the side of the truck and sat down beside the tire. Billy Ray straightened up as tall as possible and clapped his hands over his head, and the duck jumped and Billy Ray ushered the disoriented bird into the underbrush towards the valley and farther the river.
"Don't get! Shoo! Shoo! You're free, stupid! Time served!"
The duck looked back at him, unaware of the gift it was receiving, and Billy Ray barked,
"Go on now," he chided. "You don't have to do this anymore."
The duck took a few more steps before stopping to peck at an anthill. Billy Ray kicked a plume of sand and the duck scattered.
"Shoo, goddammit, get to getting. Go be a duck again."
The stars bearing witness, Billy Ray herded the duck deeper into the country. A big man chasing a waterfowl through the desert, stomping and swearing, growing angry at what he perceived to be a lack of gratitude, urging it forward until, at the ridge, the duck spread wing and drifted into the black expanse, and Billy Ray watched it glide into the dark canyon until it disappeared from his vision and became another piece of the sky. Going gone with the radio on, Billy Ray was more than a mile down the road devouring the asphalt moonlight at 80 miles an hour before the fat man even flushed the toilet. He passed the night in his motel room naked, smoking cigarettes and waiting for the sun to find the courage to rise. Between lines, he chewed his fingernails until they bled. His mouth was dry. Cocaine mixed with solitude was a whole different drug. There was no one to talk at, no one to bounce off of. With nothing exterior to absorb his energy, he went inside of himself, too deep, spelunking the caves without light where it was easy to get lost. Guided only by the ember of a perpetual cigarette, he followed his nose past the concept of self and fell plunging into the deepest recesses of his identity. The unmapped and lawless fringe, the home of absolute truth, a vast, here be monsters. The bottom was shallow. His thoughts, disparate, erratic, condemning, buzzed with the significance of epiphany. Extremes became mirrors. In the reflection, opposites dissolved. Two ideas alternated in his head. You cannot because you can no longer, and enough is only enough when there isn't any more. Revelations, credos, silent prayers. He wished he'd stolen more beer. Somewhere around 4, he smoked his last Winston, killed the lights, and listened without blinking to the walloping of his heart. His biggest fear was to hear it stop. He knew he would most likely die in a motel room just like this one, in a town whose name he forgot, solitary and companionless and far away from anyone that might care. In the end, all he would amount to was a task for housekeeping, remembered by the sheets he ruined, by a mattress thrown away. As his body blued, the maid would call the manager and the manager would call the police and someone would be summoned to collect him. His brother, his sons, maybe his ex-wife, whichever unlucky person answered the phone first. And they would be forced to come to whatever nameless place finally killed him and decide what to do with his bones. To whoever drew the shortest straw, his death would be one last inconvenience. Or maybe not. There were other ways. He could get lucky like Buddy Holly and die in an aerial disaster, or honor the statistics and go on the highway in a tangle of bent steel. Best case scenario, he'd pop an aneurysm on stage. Thank you, reality. That's my time. At least then he'd make the papers. The room was cold. His skin felt like paper. Thin. Insufficient. He sat up, leaned over the nightstand, and cleared a line with each nostril. "There it is," he said and smiled. His teeth felt like dentures. The cocaine swung him to his poles. Up and down were the same direction. At the heights of his delusion, he romanticized his lifestyle, fancying himself a scion of a dying breed of restless ones. A hobo, a minstrel, an American Bedouin. An itinerant anthropologist collecting the lost histories of the forgotten. The miles he traveled, the truths he acquired, the people. He served the people. "I am a missionary. I go when others stop." Billy Ray Schaefer was not a smart man, but after years of frontline exposure, he understood people on a preternatural level. Their secrets, the intricacies of their reasoning. He knew the whys to their whats. And despite his baseline loathing, he admired their toughness in the face of futility. They were indelible, as was their mercy. Through them, he experienced himself. Mamas, he sang, lighting his last cigarette, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. His logic, like the cocaine in his blood, was circuitous and racing. Comedians are brave. Bravery is noble. Nobility is akin to heroism. Comedians are heroes. Occasionally, when the chemicals were right, he was able to take pride in these elaborate equations. But here and now, in this room, in this light, he saw this was another of his manipulations. Yet more smoke rising from the ashes of his career. Heroes don't stay in off-ramp motels. This was no Valhalla. If he was brave, he would fit his brain for a bullet. But he was not brave. He was a mirage. A pillar of salt, frozen, and forever looking back. The 90s were over. Leno was canceled. Carson was dead. Comics like him were a vestigial tale the industry had failed to sever. Road Dog. Hack. He knew what he was, and he didn't want to be alone with himself. He shut his eyes. Thump, thump. Thump, thump. Soon the darkness was too much. He turned on the lamp and opened the drawers in the nightstand until he found the Bible. Ripping a blank page from the back of the book, he tore a rectangle from the thin sheet and folded it in half. The ashtray was laden with spent butts, the longer ones of which he emptied of their last strands of burnt tobacco until he had enough. He arranged the remnants along the crease in the rectangle and dusted the tobacco with a flurry of cocaine. With a seasoned twist of his thick fingers, he brought the paper to his tongue and licked it shut. Fully nude, Billy Ray sat on the edge of the bed and lit the coolie. The resonated tobacco was foul to breathe, and the burnt cocaine smelled like aspirin taste, but the effect was immediate and exquisite. The room became brighter, and the details of the varying motifs pronounced themselves. He could count the petals of the flowers on the dull yellow wallpaper, and he found infinitely interesting and complex designs in the stucco ceiling. It all made sense. Symbols are meaningless. Borders are lines. Land is the opposite of water, and water is the opposite of air. It went on like this, the room filling with crude freebase as the ashes burnt the sheets, a man on the cusp of it all. When the cigarette was gone, he was meteoric and listless and dripping with sweat despite the heavily conditioned air. A car drove past his windows. Slivers of headlight pierced the blinds. Two worlds, inside and out. This is mine and that is theirs. As long as I have money, they don't have me. This was one of the things he knew. He retrieved his nest egg from his suitcase and arranged the bills by denomination on the bedspread. $3,743. The total was comforting. It was nice to know exactly how much he was worth. He went to the sink and brushed his teeth until his gums were raw and bleeding. He spat in the sink and splashed water on his face and blotted dry with a towel. Catching himself in the mirror, he marveled at his nude entirety. He slapped at his chest and his shoulders. The meat sounded different. He turned sideways and inspected his barreled profile, leaning his head back until his chin undoubled and sucking in his gut. Look at you. Just look at you. There was still a lot of him, but what was once hard had gone soft. He frowned. It reminded him of the armadillo. In prison, one day on the yard, he joined a group of inmates gathered near the razor wire-crowned fence. He assumed they'd found a piece of contraband tossed over from the outside world, or, God willing, a hole in the chain link. But when he reached the front of the herd, what he saw was new and disgusting and dead. At first, he assumed the creature was a mutant pig born of incestuous congress, or an abominable hybrid. But Tall Terry, who claimed, before the meth really got a hold of him, to have clean cages at the zoo in Branson and was therefore attributed an air of expertise in all matters of biology, explained to the crowd that this four-legged abomination was nothing more than an armadillo picked clean of its shell by birds. All the inmates nodded and agreed, searching the body for a cause of death until someone kicked the carcass and a bloom of plump maggots rose from its skin. At this, the crowd cheered, calling attention from the guards who came and broke up their viewing and returned them to their monotony. The armadillo dominated conversation for the coming weeks. A few inmates memorialized the creature. They began to refer to it as Shelley, with tattoos, but the design, a muscle-bound and snarling pig-looking thing wrapped in a husk of metallic armor and puffing steam from its nostrils, failed to remember Shelley accurately. Looking at himself in the mirror above the sink, Billy Ray remembered what they'd actually seen near the fence. A weak and indefensible and hairy pink beast robbed of its hardness and filled up with bugs. He shadowboxed his reflection until they were both gasping and wet. Breathing heavy, he collapsed on the bed and took long pulls from a 2-liter of Dr. Pepper. The soda was thick in his throat. He checked the bottle of vodka on the nightstand, but it was still empty, so he counted his money once more. Meditative, covetous, stacking the cash into $1,000 towers before returning it to the secret pocket inside of his suitcase. When that was finished, he laid back and touched himself, pulling without finesse or lubrication, not due to arousal but compelled by a compulsion. This was what came next. The procedure was mechanical, gratuitous, asexual. He thought about nothing, tried to think about nothing, tried not to think about Olivia, who had been his wife. He tried to think about the girl from last night, but in his memory, she had no face. She was just a body, but so was he. They were ghosts last night, and that was fine. It worked. He wiped the results on the bedspread. After, unsatiated, he turned out every conceivable pocket for a cigarette. When the search came up empty, he reached for the ashtray and flipped through the Bible for another blank page.
Wednesday. He awoke at near noon, his face hatched by the sunlight clawing through the slats in the cheap plastic blinds. Bars of light segmented the darkness. The room looked like a cage built for an angel. The pillowcase was soaked, the sheets damp. He sat up and bile filled his throat. His eyes were poached eggs. His teeth hurt, and his mouth was as dry as if he sucked on a vacuum. "Fuck," he said, greeting the day. He stumbled to the sink and folded his body to the faucet and drank tap water in gulping slurps. He stood up, bracing himself in the basin, loosed a burp, the battery taste of stomach acid registering on the back of his tongue. He repeated himself, "Fuck, fuck." Mornings hurt. He was used to this. The shower knobs were sticky. He twisted the knob marked H to its limit and stood in the blistering water until his skin went numb. The soap smelled like candles. He refused to lather. He pissed in the stream, bright yellow, almost orange, but no blood. That was good. He had had a few scares. He dressed, packed, and entered the fresh afternoon. The sky was flat, a dull turquoise patched with thin clouds. They drifted like smears on a lens. On his way to the staircase, he passed a woman pushing a cart of cleaning supplies. "Morning," he said. She kept pushing. There was a liquor store in the strip mall across the street. He loaded his bags in the car and crossed the parking lot. He was slaked with sweat when he entered the store. The impurity stung his eyes. He bought a pint of vodka and two packs of cigarettes and asked the clerk for directions to the nearest McDonald's. He preferred the coffee at McDonald's because it tasted the same everywhere, a rare point of consistency in his day. Constants were a luxury in his life. He drank coffee splashed with vodka and smoked cigarettes on a picnic table in a small park across the street from the Trinidad Chronicle building, killing time until 1:30 Mountain, 12:30 Pacific, the time when Red Haberstadt, his longtime manager and one-time friend, took lunch and started drinking for the day. He never called Red's cell phone. It was only for emergencies, cancellations, missed flights, car accidents. Billy Ray wasn't sure, but making less money than a shitting duck felt like an emergency. He hated cell phones. They created accountability. They allowed him to be located. Over the years of mercenary travel, Billy Ray had grown accustomed to riding rogue. He preferred to be out of pocket. He called home when he needed to. Otherwise, he was a rumor. Now he never called home because there was no home to call. Like most of his life's complexities, the phone was his wife's decision. When cellular phones first came out, her brother had worked for US West and he got them a deal. $200 isn't much to pay for peace of mind, he'd say from behind his desk made of handsome red wood. His name was Tucker, and he grinned like a date rapist. Billy Ray's wife did all the talking, while Billy Ray rubbed the rich wood smooth grain and calculated his brother-in-law's commission. His wife was beaming when they left her brother's office. "Now we can talk whenever we want," she'd said. Billy Ray said nothing. That was 15 years ago. A subtle breeze tickled the park in which he sat, animating the grass and the bushes and the limbs of the trees. The breeze felt good in his hangover. He took off his shirt and let the wind at his body, soaking in the radiance of the high white sun. Billy Ray flipped open the phone and turned it on. He always expected it to be heavier. It held so much. He had no idea how it worked. He understood cellular phones as well as he understood his wife's need to own one. Coffee had gone bitter. He lit another smoke. When the phone was booted, he pulled out his wallet and located Red's card and thumbed the number labeled CELL under the small gray screen. The only numbers saved into the phone's memory were his wife's and the girl from Madison, Wisconsin, who looked like his wife on the day they'd met. They each had to enter their numbers themselves. He didn't know how to save them. Before he pressed the send button, he outlined his position one last time. Under the counsel and guidance of Red Haberstadt, his earnings had atrophied, resulting in the unrecognizable ramshackle embarrassment he called a career. The degradations have been extensive and disgusting. Shows in Midwestern sports bars during Monday Night Football, where the ambushed locals want to skin you because you're the reason they turned off the TVs. Moribund nooners in nursing homes, they're called retirement communities now, for crowds of abandoned geriatrics no longer physically capable of laughter. The clubs he worked were shitholes. They pushed chicken tenders and buckets of beer, filled their calendars with hypnotists and ventriloquists and triple X-rated magicians. C rooms, or worse, regional portals to hell, the Laugh Stop in Spokane, crackers in Indianapolis, the Jacksonville Funny Bone, graveyards with a two-item minimum. He couldn't creep screaming if no one would hear it. The stakes were too low for all the anguish involved. Part of it was his fault for refusing fossilization. Would have been easy to lay up, set his watch for 45 minutes, put his head down, wait for the alarm, to cash in on nostalgia, to start all of his premises with "remember when?" and "back in my day." But Billy Ray wasn't smart like that, and he had too much skin in the game. He wasn't some petrified artifact rolling up the sleeves on his blazer. Whether it was spite or pride, he still gave a shit. And unlike the hacks he crossed paths with on the road, their notebooks empty, their acts gone ossified and lifeless, dragging their prop cases behind them like a dog's ass across the carpet, Billy Ray was still good at the job. His act was still breathing, alive, more alive than him. He remained undeniably funny, and his name retained meaning among a certain demographic, albeit a small one without much loyalty or expendable income. There was sweat and heartbeats in what he did, and occasionally, among the easy local references and the hoary crowd work, flashes of the old Billy Ray shone through. Faint sparks of brilliance, like a light in the distance seen through the darkness and fog. He could still harness the moment. When he was present and realized, there were few who could improvise on his level, or at his speed, since Robin Williams quit cocaine. He knew how to seize the now, how to occupy the membrane that divides then from when. The absurd acuity of his mental machinations gave birth to moments of truly vital comedy. He was the quintessential live act. He had to be seen to be believed, like Warfare or Birth. When he was young, he could take off on a premise running only to catch up to his own flight of imagination 60 minutes later, his clothes soaked and the air itself crackling with the urgency of what he'd done. Those days were gone. But even drunk and coked and spun and pilled, he still killed harder than the reductive drivel being peddled in theaters and arenas by the skeletons he envied. Despite his failures with sobriety, monogamy, business, and fatherhood, he was still funny. And funny is the hardest thing to be. He wrote himself a note last night. At the peak of his frenzy, he purged a few paragraphs, staining the hotel stationery while he smoked reclaimed tobacco wrapped in Gideon paper. Most of it was unintelligible gibberish, the disjointed mess, a result of his brain moving faster than his hand. His thoughts skipped like rocks across water. One line, a joke maybe, said, "Too many baskets, not enough eggs. Too bad you can't eat baskets." Another demanded hand sandals, question mark, question mark, question mark. The question marks writ large, underlined, imploring, then later, hand sandals equals mark. Handles? There were columns of numbers with their sums total beneath the banner, blood money. Sketches of cowboys and crude Chinamen wore similar hats. On a separate page, in a slower, more deliberate script, he penned a letter to his once wife. Early in their courtship, he had made a habit of sending her postcards. Treacle-dripping gestures of long-distance longing. The dispatches were earnest and embarrassing, and fat with forced, beat-aping poetics. But Olivia liked them. And for years, he sent one every weekend. Then most weekends, then when he remembered, then he forgot. He hadn't written to her in a long time. "Dearest, sweetest, truest Olivia, why can I only talk to you through dead trees? Why can't I call you on the stars and have my voice carried express by big-breasted birds? Then they could sing it to you, and it would always be good news. Oh, Liv, there isn't enough beer. I don't know what I got myself into. I'm buried, but I learned to breathe the dirt. I know where you are, and I still can't find you. I'm the one who needs the help this time, but that's an old song, and I want to forget the words. It's all a big Tootsie Pop. I've never made it without biting. Oh, live, live, lively live. I've breathed too much dirt. I think I'm allergic to air. Remember when we used to scream out the moonroof? Remember when our bed was too small? I remember. I want to get healthy and move to Vermont. We could grow cheese. We could ice skate all year. Where did it all fall down, baby? When did we give it all away? I went to bed one time and I woke up alone. I know we had it once. I went to war for it. I took a bite from the sky. I did whatever they asked. They couldn't get enough of me. And Red told me, they can kill you, but they can't eat you. Well, they ate me. They boiled my bones for soup. Remember my first letterman? We watched it from the Tropicana. They comped the room, and I ate shrimp, and you had crab, and you were so proud, and I was so proud to have made you so proud. Where did that guy go? The guy that got free crab. I'm too alive to be this dead, baby. But isn't that what all the tombstones say? Anyways, gotta go. I think I hear them towing my house. With love, seriously, folks. The one known as. P.S. There's worse things than being broke, but I can't afford to find out. Please send money for the stamp. He read it twice, crumpled the paper, stuffed the ball inside his empty coffee cup, and crushed the cup between his knees. There was a word for what this was, but he couldn't think of it. He tried to remember, but the term escaped him, just out of grasp on the bleeding tip of his tongue. The word was eulogy. The person he wrote that to no longer existed, but neither did the person who wrote it. He stubbed his cigarette on the table, stood up, sat back down, never mind. There were other things to think about, things he could fix. He opened his joke books and jotted down handles. Perfect, he thought. Now I can write off the room. He checked his watch. Lunchtime in Hollywood. Red would be made to answer. He would not answer to Red. He took a snort of warm vodka, pressed his knuckles into his thigh until they popped, and slapped himself on the cheek. Ready. Set. All right. The phone was small in his hand. It looked like a toy. Looked like pretend. He pressed the green button with his thumb and put the receiver to his ear. You aren't a pussy. Don't you go soft. Without ringing, the call went straight to voicemail. Motherfucking shit. He hung up the phone and redialed the number, and again the message repeated. You have reached Red. You know what I said. If you're calling this number, you better be dead. He slapped the phone shut and got to his feet. Across the park, in the shadow of a pagoda, three children kicked a rubber ball, playing monkey in the middle with a fourth. The monkey didn't look like he was having fun. Billy Ray put his shirt back on, suddenly cold now that the sun had gone behind the clouds. I'll be goddamned, he said, and that was precisely how he felt. Zadie's was the first bar Billy Ray found when he got off the highway. Sans a few lifers hunched over their old styles, it was empty when he arrived. The bartender was a shriveled black man with a frying pan face, his spine contorted into a shape like a prawn. When Billy Ray asked him for a greyhound, the man said he only made cocktails on ladies' night. So Billy Ray, unable to imagine a woman setting foot in this dank chamber, requested a glass of vodka and a glass of grapefruit juice, making sure to flash his bankroll. Grunting, the man complied, and Billy Ray tipped well for the opportunity to mix his own drink. The drive north to Pueblo on I-25 had been a winding, hour-long descent. Mountains of red rock gave way to forests and pastures, then dead drags of desiccated nothing, and the gas station ghost towns of Ludlow, the site of the massacre, and Colorado City, the site of the golf course, until from the ruin appeared the first traces of Pueblo, an industrial town ringed by single-story ranch homes arranged in polite suburban neighborhoods built within driving distance from the aged gray mills that forged the steel on which the city survived. The men who worked the mills were hard and sawed off. On the breaks from the furnaces, they drank. At four, they poured in pipe fitters and boiler makers and machinists and welders, scorched men with bulging forearms and thick red hands, and the bartender jumped to work, frantic, setting them up with shots of brown liquor and mugs of headless beer, so cold steam rose when the men touched the glass. They dropped the shots in the mugs and poured the concoction into the holes in their chapped faces. paying in cash and chain smoking and filling the jukebox with Megadeth and Thin Lizzy and Judas Priest. They walked stiffly and sat their battered bodies down slow. No one played darts or shot pool. Billy Ray nursed his greyhound in a booth next to the bathroom while the men drank off the residue of hours of heat and labor, some ducking into the bathroom in small packs, only to return vibrating and pie-eyed, rubbing their noses and slapping each other on the back, their faces more pliable, their postures less dejected. Billy Ray's toes started tapping. Over the years of hardcore chemical exploitation, he developed an extrasensory awareness for deviance. Not only did he know when the game was afoot, he could tell you who was playing and by exactly what rules. With his learned eye, Billy Ray studied a man at the bar who shook many hands. The man wore a khaki fishing vest and a red Kansas City Chiefs ball cap that shaded his face blank. His cargo shorts revealed two legs, one made of aluminum, the other skin and bone and muscle. The man was popular amongst the crowd. Steelworkers approached him, and he greeted them with an extended handshake. Then he put his hand in one of his two pockets on his vest and followed up with another handshake. The man was smooth, working with magician's efficiency. He kept the interaction short. Everyone left with a smile. Billy Ray opened his wallet and moved $40 to his front pocket. Then, emptying his drink, he stood up from the sunken booth and walked in a metered pace to the bar and stood beside the man. Casual, unassuming, he came to dance, but not to lead. Billy Ray laid his hands flat in the bar and tried to appear cool. The man was looking away from him, watching sports highlights on a silent TV above the bar. On the TV, a man in a blue uniform dodged men in white uniforms as he carried a football from one end of the field to the other. Upon his arrival at the far end zone, his teammates swarmed him in celebration. The closed caption read, "End to end for the kid from South Bend, as the Bills steal a nail-biter from New England." The man slapped the bar. "Fucking Buffalo!" "You're telling me," Billy Ray agreed. "I took a bath on that one." "Me too," the man said to the screen. "But that's what I get for betting on the fucking Snatriots." The man turned from the TV, and when Billy Ray saw his face, or lack thereof, he caught himself before he audibly grimaced. Sausage was the first thing that came to mind. Red licorice was the second. The man had been melted. The front of his head more scoured than burnt. The ears, just holes. The skin as tight and red as pepperoni, the same color as his lips. The lack of delineation gave his mouth the appearance of a puncture wound slid in above his chiseled chin. His eyes, black and eyebrowless and lasciviously wet, bulged out of his skull. His cheekbones jutted like suitcase handles. He looked like unfinished taxidermy. "Luckily the Chiefs came through," the man said, tipping his hat. Billy Ray collected himself, fighting the urge to look away. Arrowhead, he stammered. "Now that's a hell of a stadium." "If you haven't seen a football game at Arrowhead, you haven't seen a football game. It gets loud. Those fans are wild." "Pound the drum. Here we come," said the man through the crack in his face. "It's like a bomb went off." Billy Ray leaned on the bar, angling for the bartender's attention. The deep brown wood was cool and polished, buff grainless by countless forearms. The acacia or burnished oak scrimshod with epitaphs and elegies. A carving near Billy Ray's elbow read, "Futile and fucked." Another under his wrist read, "Twig seat." And next to it, inscribed in a different hand, "R.I.P. Twig." Billy Ray signaled to the bartender, but the bartender was busy on the other end of the room. Out of options, Billy Ray faced the man and, assuming it to be a rare kindness, locked his eyes and stared him full in the face. "Who's your team?" asked the man. "The Donkeys." "Well," the man sighed, "as long as it's not the Raiders." "Fuck the Raiders." "Amen." "You from KC?" "Used to be. I was out there a few months ago." "I ain't been back in a while. They cleaned it up." "That's what I hear. It was nice. I was working downtown near the water." "Pipeline?" "Actually," he said, affecting a practiced nonchalance, "I'm a comedian." "I'll be dipped," the man decreed. "I've never met a comedian before." Billy Ray had set this trap up many times, and it rarely failed, at least not with laymen. Based on his experience, the only people who don't want to talk to comedians are beautiful women in New York and Los Angeles, and higher-ups in showbiz. Outside of big cities, meeting a comedian was the equivalent of meeting an astronaut or a lion tamer. The novelty guaranteed at least 3 minutes of intent conversation, 3 minutes of intrigue, and 3 minutes was more than enough time for a man like Billy Ray. The bartender came, and Billy Ray ordered a Coors, wary of appearing high maintenance in front of the melted man. He paid for the beer and raised the mug and tipped it towards the man. Fuck the Raiders. Fuck the Raiders. The beer was too cold to taste. When he drank, the man's Adam's apple bobbled libidinously. The pump of the abraded pink flesh reminded Billy Ray of a dog's penis on its way to hard. Where were you playing in KC? Stanford's? That's right. I've seen a couple shows there. Anyone good? The man adjusted his hat. There was this one guy, I can't remember. My ex, she got tickets from her job. Some black guy, but he was funny. Must not have been that funny if you can't remember his name. The man tilted his head as if seeding the point. I used to bartend at this bar down by there. The owner of Stanford's would come in sometimes. Now there's a character. Drank cream sherry over ice. Wore a wig sometimes. Craig? The King of Sting. Billy Ray nodded. One time I was there, when it came time to pay me, he offered me a check or double my check in cocaine. The man's eyes flared. It looked like peeled grape set in a hamburger patty. What'd you do? I took the coke. Blow can't bounce. The man laughs, splitting his face open like a rotten gourd. Relieved, Billy Ray looked away and smiled. Voila. Hey, Adam, I'm about to get what I want. The pink-faced man's name was Kurt Fletcher, and he lost his face to an exploding propane tank on his 31st birthday. Not much of a story, I'm sorry to say. A snake bite took his leg. He drove a Ford Bronco, baby blue, the suspension lifted and tires monstrous. Along with cocaine, Kurt Fletcher sold vacuums and Darvocets and bags of weed, and he claimed to have a line on automatic weapons just in case. He cut out generous stripes of powder on the Bronco owner's manual, and Billy Ray snorted them through a receipt while the man exhibited the power of his aftermarket subwoofers by playing Pantera at a progressively louder volume. Everyone's moving to Bose, but I swear by JBL. These are the Club 5000s, 5 1/4, 2 in front and 4 in the back. The conversation plumbed the depths of Billy Ray's apathy, but the man persisted. Listen to that bass. It's really something. He had to yell to be heard. Right? You gotta pay for power like this. The cocaine was exceptional. Billy Ray snuffed greedily, causing his inhibitions to scatter and his own self-worth to rise as he grew more dynamic with each lusty nose load. Reality sharpened. His perception honed his senses to a fine edge that bordered on precognition. His will was paramount, definitive. Nothing could begin without his consent. The cocaine spun his face cold, but the source of his intuition burned like a coal in the center of his forehead. This is important, he thought. I am important. Listening to this man was a nice thing to do. Billy Ray was the one doing the favor. Inflated, his ego pulsed like a second phallus. In this warped condition, he occupied the gap between knowledge and truth. Unaware of his guest's newfound omniscience, Kurt continued, undeterred. Notice how there's no rattle? This ain't nigger rig. They sell for 12, but I got them for 9. Hell yeah, hollered Billy Ray. He didn't know what he was saying. Outside the truck, wind danced scraps of trash down streets paved with bricks as cars waited their turn at a four-way stop, and the newly downed sun stained the western mountaintops the color of wine and marmalade. The drivers of the waiting cars were reflected in profile in the windows of the storefronts lining the empty street, their faces made wholly rendered in the glass, aflame with the day's last light. A dentist, a pharmacy, a thrift store with a sign that read, "Everything must go." Billy Ray, coked to the gills, took it as a warning. The residual daylight, diffuse and even, shrouded the city in imminent dusk, and the early night took on a somber tone as the possibilities of day succumbed to the obligations of night. Suddenly, as he listened to Kurt Fletcher prattle on, Billy Ray found himself struck with an ambiguous sense of stewardship regarding the well-being of this freak, as if he had an obligation to save him from his role in this world, or at the very least, provide a succor. See his face, touch his skin, steal his pain, return his soul. It was in his power to help. This was all so big. Together, they were less small. Instead, like he always did, he did nothing and helped no one. Instead, he sucked cocaine up his nose until he couldn't swallow, saying, "Fucking A," when necessary, his ear perfunctory, listening only enough to nod at the appropriate intervals. Another banal question at the ready whenever the conversation ran out of muster. "That's wild, man. How'd it do on gas?" Rolling the receipt even tighter, numb and number, unable to feel the grinding of his teeth. Eventually, he interrupted Kurt Fletcher and asked to buy $200 of cocaine and 6 Valium. As he counted out the money, the man said he didn't have change. "That's okay," said Billy Ray, licking the owner's manual clean. "Keep it for the hospitality." The man gave him what he paid for, and Billy Ray tucked the pellets into his pocket. "Where's your show?" asked Kurt. "Rumors. It's connected to a hotel." "Heh. Rumors. Haven't been on that side of town in a while. I'll try to make it." "All right. Maybe I'll bring some friends." "All right." Billy Ray climbed out of the truck, out of the cocoon of cymbals and guitars, got in his rental car, and drove to the motel, swimming in waning elation as the world became a bruise. Naked, he lay in the bed with his arms crossed, the ceiling above his face craggy and peeling, the initial white gone off gray and growing darker in the corners where the walls met. Humming with the pulse of the air conditioner, the room grave cold and dark, the curtains pulled tight to prevent the pervasive luster of incandescent fast food signage, overlooked a sloped parking lot, near empty besides the semi-tractor trailers, bringing the perimeter of the asphalt. Beyond the light, a curving monolithic off-ramp delivered cars to the highway under the green glow of an LED display advertising the price of gasoline and diesel. Bristling, exhausted, Billy Ray considered a bitter scheme. He thought in serpentine loops, the logic turning back on itself and swallowing its own tail. If he didn't show up to his gig tonight, the venue would call Red, and Red would have to call him. At this point, Billy Ray would have his complete attention, albeit under negative circumstances, weakening Billy Ray's bargaining power and ceding the bulge in the argument to Red, an adroit negotiator and a tactician with a skill for lulling his clients into a sense of false obligation. The sorghum dripping off his coastal Georgia accent as he trapped his prey in a homespun web of pathos, ethos, and old-world guilt. A true bully of order. A real son of a bitch. "There's nothing worse," he once told Billy Ray, his head down, feet planted, squaring up to drive a fresh Titleist in his handmade Lambda shoes, "than a shark that knows it's a shark." Billy Ray ashes Winston on the spoiled carpet. Clock on the desk read 55 minutes to showtime, and the showroom was in the bar downstairs, less than 80 steps away by his estimate. He had time. He needed to think this through. When he was still married, he would call his wife during periods of divisive contemplation. She, empirical and clever, knew how to talk to him. She could navigate the entanglements of his brittle ego, deftly maneuvering past his artifice to the core of the matter, her methods heuristic and above condescension. The conclusions she drew were bereft of the emotion that dominated the resolutions he arrived at by himself. She could peer through the depths of his clouding bullshit. The only hokum she couldn't parse was her own. They'd been divorced for 11 years. Still carried a Polaroid over in her wallet, a candid from their trip to Maine, her crouching on a dock beside a basket of writhing lobsters, her hand touching her throat, smiling, mouth agape. The highlights in her chestnut hair gone gold with the mid-August sunlight. "There's 2 seasons in Maine," said the fishmonger. "August and the rest of the year." And she, ever the culture slut, repeated it ad nauseum, another arrow in her quiver of trite rehashings. She talked in affected soundbites, hopped vogues for sport. Her opinions were unoriginal, adopted from magazines and the famous populace she admired. She spoke like everything she said was being recorded for posterity. While there were many reasons for their divorce, legitimate reasons, of which he was ashamed, Billy Ray knew, beyond his transgressions, part of it came down to the fact that people always wanted to hear what he had to say while she had to convince them. The wife of a comedian, more than anything, wanted to be taken seriously. It drove her to bouts of hyperbole. Once, while they were lying in bed, apropos of nothing, she told him, "I wish I could talk to you, but you're not here." "I'm right here," he said, demonstrating his vicinity. "You can touch me." "That's not what I'm saying." "Then just say it. You can tell me anything. I love you." "That's the thing. If you loved me, actually loved me, I wouldn't have to say anything at all." In the darkness, he scoffed. Maybe that was the end of things. Since the divorce, they'd exchanged a few words. The lawyers did all the talking. Once on the courtroom steps, he told her, "For all that pissing and moaning you do, you really don't say much at all." She wept. He wished she had killed him right there. He sat up and dug his feet into the stiff carpet, shook his head, slapped himself sharp. He'd completely forgotten about Red. The severity of his professional troubles dwarfed in the forefront of his mind by a lengthy highlight reel comprised of his most monstrous acts of marital treachery. The lies, the infidelities, the isolation. The dwindling parts per million of the drugs in his blood compounded the mounting despair. He felt like a shell casing, hollow and burnt, waiting to go off. Slowly in the dark, he found his way to the bathroom, turned on the light, and started the shower. As he waited for the water to heat, he emptied his bladder in the warming spray and fed a Q-tip up each nostril. Showers, like everything, reminded him of her. When they first met, he and Olivia spent extended periods in hotel showers, pressing each other against a tile, alive, underwater, unconcerned with getting clean. They spent hours stuck together, limitless and unburdened, enjoying passion without responsibility until the water went cold. He thought her so strong then, so creative. Her skin softer than any kindness. All that life in her pale blue eyes. She was beautiful and willing and generous. The memory of her at 22 still raised his oldest blood. Eyes closed, head in the water, he soothed himself, thinking of her and him, who they used to be, what they used to do. He toweled off afterwards, then put his show clothes, tucking his yellowing Rock Mount shirt into his pants. The chino still pleated somehow, the fabric as blue as gas flame. Half hour until showtime. His business with Red could wait. There was nothing he could do. He needed the money, he needed the hotel room, but most pressing, he needed a drink. From the start, he knew this was going to be a long 60 minutes. There was no host, no opener, no introduction, no buffer. The sound system was faulty. The mixer was broken. We have a sound guy, but he just works karaoke. Carried through the blown speakers, his voice sounded wet and distant, all bass drenched with reverb, as if it was coming from the bottom of a well. The crowd seemed surprised when the bartender turned off the house music. He watched them look around, searching for the cause of the interruption. When he appeared before them, he saw the disdain in their eyes. They weren't here to listen. They were here to try to mate. His existence upset them. This was an ambush in peacetime. There were no posters on the wall. The tables up front were empty. The crowd, a dour collection of disinterested itinerants, dudded in khakis and Lacoste and ignorant to their hopelessness, sat itself at the bar or paired off in couples in the high-backed vinyl booths far from the stage. They were impenetrable. A connection was impossible. Not in this place. Not with these people. Staring emptily out of their heads, their faces just masks made of skin, they scowled, they groaned. They made it clear he was unwanted. He was a disappointment, an impediment, an unnecessary evil. Time slowed, the minutes viscous and dripping into each other as he struggled to deliver an amplified stranger demanding the precious moments of their lives. Pueblo, the town named Town. How long did it take you geniuses to come up with that? Nothing. I would have liked to have been in that meeting. What should we call this place? City? No, that's too hard to spell. So much nothing. The collective apathy bordered on hostility, but he continued like a professional, not letting it show, outwardly undeterred but wilting internally, soldiering on in the face of the thick silence, feeling more and more with each failed punchline like a ghoul without a tongue. His was a special hell. It was like he told them all the dates of their deaths, reflected in their plastic eyes. He saw what they saw, a deluded man pretending everything was fine, and he hated them for it, almost as much as he hated himself. This was before his nose began to bleed. At first, he didn't notice. So consuming was his chore, but then he felt it, the blood coming hot and fast, flowing in a gout off the tip of his chin and ruining his shirt. A table of women got up and left the bar at the sight of the deluge, while a man in the back of the room hollered, "Hope you brought enough for the rest of the class." Billy Ray, unshaken, this had happened before, embraced the opportunity for self-effacement. He packed his nostril with paper napkins. Who wants to see a magic trick? Making a show of the single tusk as he feigned a dignity. "Oh, sure, like none of you get high before work." This drew a chuckle. "You guys are acting like a Mormon at an orgy." Another chuckle. "Did you know Mormons have orgies? They don't call them orgies, of course. They call them youth groups." At this old, trite, repurposed joke, on the East Coast, he swapped Mormon for priest. The crowd coughed up legitimate laughter. And Billy Ray Schaefer, like a captain finding a break in the chop, put the throttle down, full speed ahead. For the next 20 minutes, he skewered the Church of Latter-day Saints. The church says you can bang 16-year-olds, but only if they're wearing their magic underwear. And I get it. You got to have rules. And for some strange, unquantifiable reason, one of the countless subtle variables that makes stand-up comedy the only living art form, the crowd ate it up. He ripped. He slashed. He barely came up for air. He found the rhythm of the room's particular heartbeat and fanned the embers of their meager adulation until they were on fire. Then he danced among the flames. He adapted. He survived. He won. And the whole time he was thinking, "You thought you had me, motherfuckers, but I can't be got." Later, sitting at the bar in his shirt wet with blood, too drunk really to keep his head up, but still pounding Jameson, he considered his possibilities. They were fewer than ever. Every decision tree, rootless, bore no fruit. The options he didn't have far outnumbered those he did. I am drowning. Bleak rumination. Nothing was concrete. He saw it all in maybes. Maybe he would separate from Red. Maybe he would win the lotto. Maybe he would kill himself. Maybe it wouldn't hurt. None of it was pleasant to think about. He shook his head, drank. The whiskey tasted like charcoal, wet amber in the glass. Olivia had no taste for brown liquor. She said it made her flush. She drank vodka, Stoli or Grey Goose in a pinch. Tom Collins, screwdrivers, a black Russian in lieu of dessert. She never wanted to taste the liquor. She masked the bad with sweet. A memory snuck in the back door of his mind. The two of them in their first apartment, him splayed out on the couch, her sitting Indian style beside a crate of records on the rug she bought in Grand Junction. A tumbler of ginger ale and vodka between her legs. Snow falling outside their barred windows. John Prine on the turntable. Her singing along. His fingers in her hair. The smell of the leather. The simple magic. The calm certitude. How warm he felt then. "Should I play another record?" she asked, looking up at him, smiling, her face impossibly bright. "Throw it on, Toots. We got nothing but time." More memories. More glimpses. How her nose wrinkled when she was nervous. How her blue eyes went gray lavender in the early light of dawn. How she draped her leg across his stomach when she slept. How she picked the olives off her pizza and saved them for last. How she carried their sons cocked up on one hip. How they looked at her like a god. How she begged him to become sober. How small she was when she cried. All the words he said, and all the words he didn't, and the divide between them, too big to scream across. "I would never do this to you. I could never do this to you. Well, we're different then, aren't we? We used to be the same. Ugh." He clamped his eyes tight against the remembrances, cutting them off, holding them in. He pushed his fists into the sockets. He kept his eyes shut until he was confident he had aborted the tears. When he opened them, she was gone, and he was alone again. Delivered back to this foreign place where his decisions were foregone and his reality was beyond his control. All he could do was ask for another drink. At the shake of his glass, the bartender, an aspiring actor named Todd, topped him off. Todd wore red suspenders that matched the crimson bow tie growing out of his throat like a rose. Todd was beautiful. His face perfect. His features fine. His skin clear. From stage, Billy Ray described him as exactly what Hitler was fighting for. After Billy Ray's set, Todd had been complimentary, fawning over the rawness. "Rock and roll, brother." Since then, he had been hospitable to a fault. "That was legendary," he said, refilling Billy Ray's glass to the brim. "You're a legend." "The headless horseman," Billy Ray slurred. He shoved money at Todd, but it was refused. "Your money's no good." "My head's a fucking pumpkin." The lounge, nothing more than a collection of wounded red vinyl booths, ring the horseshoe bar, was near empty and lit low, enough to provide the remaining faces the benefit of the doubt. A pack of businessmen stood L'd around the far elbow of the bar, chasing shots of clear liquid with lime wedges. They honked, their puckered faces twisted around the citrus, overgrown frat boys slapping the bar top after every round until the bartender healed, proudly paying for their patrons on the company card, being loud. "Hold the salt, doctor's orders." Their faces stretched bulbous, reflected in the bar's burnished grain. Further down the bar, an older couple were fully engaged in a vivid display of shameless affection. Tongues probing, hands curious. Billy Ray had seen similar presentations in prison visitation rooms. Truly wild stuff. He couldn't help but stare. They appeared to be a bit older than himself, but they'd maintained themselves better. Their faces stretched, wrinkleless by science. Their skins tanned, a color you had to pay for. The man was big-toothed and fit for his age, the sinews and veins of his sleeveless arm visible under the skin. His cheekbones sharp, his hair gone the precise silver of timber wolf fur. Every finger on his left hand was fitted with at least one ring, and he wore sunglasses despite the late hour. The woman was straight off the cover of a VHS porno tape, fabricated in a laboratory by an enemy of nature and death. Her measurements were quixotic. Her breasts massive, as if a portion by a 14-year-old boy. She would be impossible to drown. Hard and immobile, set too high in her chest. The twin globes looked ridiculous, mounted on her slight frame. Under her bleached blonde, hairspray crisp hair, her face was Beverly Hills grotesque. The inflated lips like night crawlers, her soft eyes pinned open beneath a forehead, arched surgically into a look of everlasting revelation. Like everything was incredible. Like it was all just too much. These permanently astonished eyes caught Billy Ray leering like a deaf puppy. But rather than scowling or looking away, she matched his gaze, blew a kiss, and while still maintaining eye contact, whispered something into her date's ear. The man shrugged and laughed before turning his tongue to the inside of her mouth. While Todd flitted between them, the businessman cackled. The tan couple made out, and Billy Ray continued to drink until he was smashed beyond self-recognition. Periodically, he thumbed the lump of the leather holding the cash in his pocket, the soul tangible among the ether, the only proof he was real. Tonight, he put three new $100 bills in his billfold, and all I gave them was all I had. "So okay," he said to nobody. I'm... Never mind. Illusions flickered at the edge of his vision, kaleidoscopes and faces, voices he once knew. His thoughts composed themselves in a language he could no longer understand. Delirious, undefined, neither here nor there, and approaching the verge, Billy Ray, if that was his name, retained only fragments of what happened next. He turned on his cell phone, found the number named LIV, and pressed send. At the sound of her voicemail, he hung up. Then called back, left a 10-second recording of labored breathing punctuated by a heavy sigh. Instead of calling again, he spiked the phone between his legs, bouncing off the brass footrail and snapping at the hinge. Bending forward to pick up the pieces, Billy Ray lost his equilibrium and toppled from the high stool, landing braceless on the point of his chin in a field of screaming yellow. Then he laid very still. More blood, the darkest blood, poured in rivulets from his mouth. Todd hopped the bar, eager to help, but froze when he saw the mess. Jesus Christ. The blood pooled in deep stains on the carpet, and Billy Ray remained motionless on the floor, damaged, lame, dripping in helpless calamity. The four men gathered around him, but none moved. Lordy. Call an ambulance. "No," said Billy Ray, spitting blood. "No quops." He sat up slowly, the front of him slaked, new blood on old blood. He shook his head to reaffirm his wishes, and the blood fell in sheets. "Call it anyway. There's too much blood." The augmented woman cut through the crowd. "Here, watch out. I used to be a nurse." Tying back her hair, she knelt beside him and put her hands on his shoulders firmly. "Can you hear me?" Billy Ray nodded, still painless in the shock of it all. "Good. Listen to me, okay?" She smiled, her eyes benign, and he smiled back, a twisted, leaking simper. In that moment, she was Olivia. She was his mother. She was the mother of God. "Come here." She took his head in her hands and massaged his temples with her fingertips. "Does that hurt?" He shook his head. "Good. That's real good. Can you open your mouth?" He did. A thin pellicle of blood and saliva growing between his spreading lips. "Does that hurt?" she asked, her calm tone denoting experience. He shook his head. "Excellent. Todd, I need clean towels and ice. Ronnie, give me a shirt. Who's got a flashlight?" Todd brought towels and a bucket of ice, and one of the men produced a small penlight. She had him open his mouth as wide as he could and peered inside with the light. "Stick out your tongue. Oh, yep. You about chomped a hole in your cheek." The woman instructed him to apply pressure to the wound with his tongue, packed his mouth with ice cubes, and tied a bag of ice to his side of his face with her date's tank top. "You're lucky," she said, dabbing blood off his chin with a rag. "This could have been much worse." Billy Ray nodded, This is nothing, sister. This is just what you can see. Three of the men stood up and sat him down on a stool. Todd brought him a fresh drink. The woman sat on the stool beside him, her hand on the small of his back to steady him. She held the pen light between his eyes and traced it back and forth. "You're going to feel like shit tomorrow." Billy Ray nodded, unable to speak. Didn't hurt that bad. He attempted to sip his drink, but most of it dribbled out. Todd was ready with a straw. The woman continued to tend to him, tightening his bandage, digging her breasts into his shoulder. He stared down her tank top. Tweety Bird was tattooed below her left clavicle, the initials LCH inscribed in fading cursive on her wrist. "You're going to hurt like the devil's ex-wife," she told him, snickering. The corners of her eyes were liquid silver. "You're a miracle," he thought. "I was lost and you found me." He pulled out his cash and peeled $2.50s off the rind, held the bills in front of him, not looking at them, staring down. The money seemed heavy in his fingers. Sacramental. This was the best he could do. "Sanko." The woman, curling her eyes, looked back at her date before pushing Billy Ray's hand to the bar and closing his fingers around the money. "No, honey." They locked eyes. The intimacy embarrassed him. A feeling he hadn't known in a long time welled up from a secret reserve in the core of him, running out of his pores, making brighter the dim surroundings. A sense of connectedness, at once clarifying and intoxicating. Her hand remained on his. "We have to help each other when we can." "I love you," he said. She smiled, her eyes lingering. "You are funny." Billy Ray, hoping to rid himself of attention, to restore normalcy, left the money on the bar and bought a round for everyone. He was eager to be useful to these people. Todd poured the drinks and Billy Ray proposed a toast. "Strong chins," everybody laughed. Things fell back into place. The men were Steelers from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They were in town selling new technology, some cutting-edge smelter. "If you smelt it, we dealt it." They said it was all very boring, and no one disagreed. The woman, Tammy, and the man, Ronnie, now shirtless, his skin a different orange where the tank top had covered, owned a string of rental properties up through Colorado Springs. In his free time, he restored pinball machines. Her younger years, before nursing school, she'd been a cheerleader for the Phoenix Suns. They'd been married, then divorced, and married again. They knew people in Pittsburgh. "Is that close to Harrisburg?" "No, not really." Tammy gazed at Billy Ray while the men talked hockey, burning him with her shining wet eyes. She teased her straw with the tip of her tongue. Ronnie didn't say much, but he seemed pleased by the situation, smiling broad like he knew some great truth. Billy Ray ordered another round, insisting Todd pour one for himself. Maybe his alacrity would help everyone fail to remember his helplessness. He wanted them all to forget he'd ever needed them at all. Soon, Todd locked the doors, removed his bow tie, and the party became private. Lines were laid out in the bar. Ashtrays were made available. The room filled up with smoke. One of the Steelers stacked the jukebox with Allman Brothers, and Dwayne Allman's bottleneck slide whinnied its high melancholia as his brother warned the road goes on forever. The night mounted. Everyone tried to deduce what came next. Tammy took turns two-stepping with the Steelers while Ronnie watched without protest. Unminding, tipping his bottle of Coors towards Billy Ray and nodding towards his wife with a raised eyebrow, as if to say, "It's your turn, partner. Make your move." Billy Ray raised his glass in return, a man teetering on the razored lip of lucidity. Events were blurred Polaroids, moments disconnected, A to C to G. When it was his turn, he danced with Tammy, holding her close, following her, grateful for her warmth. She whispered something he didn't hear, then repeated herself, pushing her breast into his chest while her husband watched, grinning his omnipotent smile. Did he want to come back to their place? Billy Ray followed her outside. Ronnie carried his suitcase. The truck smelled like hay. Patches of coarse orange rust showed through the paneling. The passenger door handle stuck. Billy Ray waited for Tammy to open it from the inside. Spinning slowly in the rearview mirror, a fraying dream catcher hung above the bench seat. The hard vinyl wrapped tightly in a Navajo blanket, patterned with blue and brown waves. Tammy sat between them, thigh to thigh. Ronnie's arm slung around her as he drove through the empty streets. The night was a pitiless dark. Between streetlights, the city existed in stretches of flat void beneath a moonless sky. Staring out into the ink, Billy Ray experienced none of the novelty due a passenger adrift in an ocean of unseeable possibility. Nothing was new anymore. Everything that was going to happen had already happened to him. All of this was leftovers. He'd already met these people, just their names were different. He'd been in this truck driving down this road, but it was somewhere else, in a place they had never been and would never visit. These people lived everywhere. conned by their senses into believing themselves unique and exciting. But Billy Ray knew better. The world went on without them. The smallness is what killed him. The only way these people could surprise him would be by driving off a cliff into the endless twilight. Or pulling into an abandoned lot and caving his skull in with shovels. Maybe his last words would be, "Thank you." He'd give his life for something new. At a drive-in burger joint, Ronnie turned down a street made of cobblestones, and the truck began to bounce. In the tumult, Tammy grabbed hold of Billy Ray's thigh. He looked down, assuming it was an accident, but she squeezed tighter, working up his leg toward the cardinal piece of him. He traced her hand up her arm, making sure it was connected to her shoulder, verifying this was not some hallucination. It was hard to tell anymore. He stopped at her chest. Her breasts remained steadfast. They didn't bobble in the least. As he tried to envision what they looked like when she was naked on her back, he felt fingers in his hair. He could see both of Tammy's hands. Wherever they were going, he hoped there was whiskey waiting. The old truck topped the hill and pulled off into a parking lot and eased into a space in front of a row of nondescript apartments. He fumbled with the door handle until Tammy reached over him, shoving her alterations into his groin, adding, "There's a trick to this." White light from a tall pole divided the asphalt into three distinct darknesses. He followed him into a vestibule, and Ronnie unlocked a glass door, and they walked single file up a staircase coated in drab gray carpet. At the top of the second flight of stairs, Ronnie opened another door, and they stepped into a silent room as cold as it was dark. Entering the room, Billy Ray thought of floating through space, untethered, with nothing to bring you back, until Ronnie turned on a light, and Billy Ray knew exactly where he was. A studio apartment. Bed in one corner, a full bar on the other. The walls decorated with framed photographs of a fully nude Tammy pretzeled into various uncomfortable positions. Her face was different in the photos. Younger, less plasticine, more human, alive. He took off the shoes and invited him to do the same. "Get comfortable." "What if I got a one?" said Billy Ray. He could barely stand up under the weight of his day-long drunk. "Then we'll have to chase you." There was nowhere to sit besides the bed. He leaned on the sill of the only window while Tammy got to work pouring drinks. Her husband, the man, brought out a mirror in the shape of a heart. The room throbbed with invisible momentum, imperceptible. He could hear it like a dog. Billy Ray lit a cigarette without asking if it was okay to do so. This seemed like the type of place where permission was unimportant. He sat and smoked and tried to think of something to say. Tammy handed him a glass. "Cheers,"